You are listening to an audio recording of an event hosted by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. On September 21, 2010, Jeffrey Schott of the Peterson Institute for International Economics presented his paper in the KEI conference facility as part of KEI's CORUS FTA series. The event was titled, What Policymakers Need to Know About the CORUS FTA and the Future of U.S.-Korea Trade Relations. Mr. Schott is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute working on international trade policy and economic sanctions. A question and answer session that immediately followed the presentation is included in this recording.
Thank you, and I'd like to welcome you all to the Korea Economic Institute. My name is Troy Sangaron, and I'm the Director of Congressional Affairs here. And this morning we're going to take and do a presentation by Jeffrey Schott of the Peterson Institute on a paper he did for us on essentially what policymakers need to know about the CORUS FTA. As I'm sure you're all aware, about 3 years ago, the United States and Korea signed the CORUS Free Trade Agreement. And in that time, there's been a series of different things that have happened. I was actually thinking about this yesterday. And on a personal note, my sister has taken and graduated from college and lived in three different countries since the FTA was signed. So while perhaps that's not relevant specifically to the Free Trade Agreement, it just kind of goes to show that over that period of time, there's been a lot of change that's taken place. And what we're going to do today is try and look at some of that change and see how it impacts the FTA and the policy going forward. And with that, I will turn it over to Jeff.
Well, thank you very much, Troy, and many thanks to KEI and Jack for inviting me here to join you today. There are a lot of people in the audience who know a lot about this this topic and have been engaged in the discussions both before the negotiations and during and since and trying to determine what's best for the United States and for Korea and our bilateral relationship. And so I will try to just make some brief comments on the status of the agreement going forward. And the status of the agreement and prospects for its ratification, and then open it up for questions and answers and get your insights as well. What I'd like to do is start with some brief historical points, because often instructive for our current policy debate to know what's happened before. And let me start in the year 2000. 10 years ago, I was asked by then Korean Trade Minister Han Duck-soo, who is now the ambassador here, if I would be interested in looking into the costs and benefits of pursuing a Korea-U.S. free trade agreement. It seemed like an unusual request at the time because it didn't seem like Korea was a ready, willing, and able partner for the United States, particularly given the types of agreements and the comprehensive nature of agreements that the United States had pursued. But it was interesting. When I mentioned that to Han Duck-soo, he said, that's exactly the reason why I am interested in this analysis. Because we have a Korean industry that doesn't want to lower its trade barriers, is not interested in competition, and is likely to continue to fall behind its competitors in the region, particularly China, if the Korean economy is not does not have more competition, which would then spur productivity growth and innovation. That was a key insight, which applies actually to all other countries that engage in free trade agreements, including the United States. The objective is to use the agreements to spur productivity, growth, and innovation to improve competitiveness. And indeed, it was that insight that helped push Korean policy reform over the coming years, including in agriculture, so that by the time that Korean officials met with Bob Zelik a few years later, they were in a position to say, yes, we want to go forward. Fast forward to 2007. In April of 2007, the deal was sealed with a handshake. after some tense moments that always occur at the end of trade negotiations. That deal was not the deal that was signed. Over the coming 3 months, in large measure in response to the May 10th, 2007, bipartisan, so-called bipartisan arrangement between congressional Democratic leaders and the Bush administration, new provisions were added, or some other provisions revised in the text of the agreement, covering various issues of importance and priority to the Congress. And that deal was then signed on June 30th, 2007, just before the expiration of Fast Track or Trade Promotion Authority. So it's that the CORUS FTA does qualify for Fast Track procedures because it got in under the wire. What's happened since June 30th, 2007? As Troy noted, a lot of things have changed in his family. Here in Washington, we've had three coaches of the Redskins. No playoff victories, but three coaches. But that's probably less important for the U.S.-Korea relationship. Much more important, we've had a global economic crisis, which had a dramatic impact on trade, particularly in the auto sector. But it also witnessed a big change in U.S.-Korea relations because Korean officials stepped up to the plate and assumed leadership responsibilities and obligations to help work with other leading trading nations to help manage the crisis and move towards a sustainable economic recovery. And indeed, this year, Korea is chairing the G20 group and is making a constructive contribution to the management of the global economy, as well as in other areas of great interest to the United States, such as climate change and green growth strategies. So we've had this deepening economic partnership because of the shared responsibilities and efforts that the United States and Korea have done together to help deal with this very dramatic economic crisis. Over the past 3 years, we've also witnessed a large number of new trade deals negotiated by Korea with its important trading partners, notably the European Union and India. Korea is also in the final stages of negotiations with Australia and Canada and a number of other countries. Active deals, either concluded or in the process of negotiation, now cover more than 50% of Korean merchandise trade. And if you include Japan and China, where talks have either been suspended or are in the process of beginning to percolate, though with a multi-year horizon, you get over 80% of Korean trade covered by free trade agreements. Including the United States, but that only works if we, if the deal is enters into force. This period of time has also witnessed a steady decline in the market share in Korea for U.S. exporters. In the year 2000, U.S. exports accounted for about 18% of Korean imports. That market share was cut in half over the decade. And while Korea's total merchandise trade more than doubled over the past decade, the U.S. trade with Korea increased only from about $67 billion in 2000 to $85 billion in 2008. It went down sharply in 2009 because of the global recession. It's gone up sharply so far in 2010, about to the levels of 2008. Slow growth in U.S. trade exports and imports with Korea compared to the more dramatic growth that Korea has had with its other trading partners, and there the story is largely China. And finally, the last notable thing I will mention in terms of what has happened in the last few years is increased North Korean aggression and threats. Not to be taken lightly, and with great implications for overall U.S.-Korean relations. Now, what's the current status of the talks, of the agreement? In Korea, the agreement has passed a significant hurdle in the National Assembly with passage a little over a year ago, or approval in the Foreign Affairs and Trade Committee of the National Assembly. And it has sat there since then, awaiting comparable action in the U.S. Congress. The ratification process in Washington has not yet begun. And that may change, and it is foreseen to change within the next 6 months as a result of a meeting that President Obama and President Lee Myung-bak had on the sidelines of the Toronto summit, G20 summit, last June, where they agreed that they would task their negotiators to come up with solutions to the problems that were inhibiting progress on the ratification of the CORUS FTA in the U.S. Congress. The chief negotiators have been tasked with coming up with solutions and bringing them to Seoul at the time of the next G20 summit in early November. And if they succeed, then the president's handshakes will mean that the ratification process can move forward in the U.S. In early 2011. On that timetable, the agreement could enter into force in late 2011 or January 2012. Now, that assumes that the negotiators can deal with the flashpoints in the U.S. ratification debate. And there are quite a few, but most prominently the ones involve trade in autos and beef. This is well known around town. Bilateral auto trade is one of the most significant aspects of our commercial relationship, and bilateral trade was about $12 billion in two-way trade was $12 billion in 2008, and Korea had about a $10 billion surplus. The CORUS FTA gives Korea a small price advantage over other importers as a result of the elimination of the 2.5% U.S. auto tariff and a 10-year phase-out of the 25% U.S. tariff on light trucks. You might say, why do we have a 25% tariff on light trucks? It's because we were trying to keep out Volkswagen vans from the United States in 1963 pursuant to a chicken war with the European Union. Ernie, you can ask Ernie for the details on that. He was probably driving one of those Volkswagen vans during his hippie days in the 60s. But that type of retaliation has stuck and has been very difficult to undo in the course of a number of multilateral trade rounds and bilateral free trade agreements. And so that still exists. Of course, the value of it may be questioned because as a result of the crisis and sharp increase in oil prices, we have less demand for these types of vehicles than existed earlier in the decade. But there are experts in the audience on the auto market who could might want to offer their opinions on this. Regarding beef, the CORUS FTA actually doesn't do much with regard to the main problem, which is the sanitary restrictions that have blocked beef totally when the, since December 2003, when the BSE crisis erupted and there was a total import ban in Korea. The free trade agreement itself phases out the 40% Korean tariff on U.S. beef, and that is useful for U.S. exporters. Resolution of the beef issue is significant for two reasons. One, to increase U.S. exports to Korea, and to set a precedent for resolving similar problems with other countries, especially Japan. And so that is crucial. Let me spend just a minute on each of these two big flashpoints, because I think this is what the negotiators are grappling with and trying to figure out how to resolve them. The auto issues are a major stumbling block, and there has been opposition from Ford and Chrysler and the auto workers union. GM has been quietly supportive. They have a big investment and a profitable investment in Korea. So it isn't a united front of the auto industry in the United States, but there are, the problem is one where there are a number of states in old line production that has been severely affected. And so that is showing up in the political debate in the Congress. The critics argue that trade should be more balanced and that the FTA needs to be rewritten to require Korea to eliminate non-tariff barriers, discriminatory tax policies, and fuel, emission, and safety standards that they claim impede import and distribution of foreign cars in Korea. The agreement tries to do that. The EU-Korea tries to do it as well. Undoubtedly has made a lot of progress in removing some of these concerns, but not all. So that remains an area where the negotiators are focusing their attention. They are not focusing their attention on the market share arguments propounded by a number of members of Congress. The call for more balanced trade amounts to a managed trade manifesto that is seductive in political terms and irrational in economic terms. And it also confuses the point that the Korean market for automobiles is about one-tenth the size of the U.S. market. Sales are a little over 1 million units a year. Our sales, when they were depressed last year, were a little over 10 million units. Now, there is an interest in selling more cars, U.S.-made cars in Korea. And undoubtedly, the agreement, if implemented, will result in an increase in sales. But given the size of the market, the fact that U.S. exporters, that U.S.-based production usually does not extensively serve foreign markets outside of North America from U.S.-based plants, there is a question about just how many more cars could be shipped from Detroit or from Ohio or elsewhere in the United States to a distant market. Rather, it would be served as GM is serving the Korean market out of its production plants in Korea. But we can talk more about that. I could spend the entire time available just on autos. But what are the negotiators likely to do in terms of reform package on autos? I think efforts have focused on improving transparency of Korean regulatory policies and the operation of dispute resolution procedures in the auto sector. And the negotiators have been looking very carefully at the provisions of the EU-Korea deal to see if there are better results that have come out of there or better ways of pursuing these objectives in the language put forward in the EU-Korea deal. In addition, both governments have sought to encourage innovation in their auto industries and joint ventures that would spur investment and employment in both countries. One example is the LG Chem investment in Michigan that President Obama helped launch in July of 2010. So I think we'll probably see a combination of improved procedures to monitor regulatory proceedings in Korea that will help assuage concerns about bias, improve procedures for the resolution of disputes, hopefully before it gets into the litigation phase, and much greater cooperation in terms of public-private partnerships to spur increased production and employment in both countries. On beef, the issue is a lot easier, in part because the problem has mostly been resolved. As a result of an agreement reached 2 years ago, most U.S. beef is now allowed access to the Korean market. Not 100%, and there is a commitment from Korea that it will bring its practices in compliance with the guidelines of the World Organization for Animal Health. I think in this area, U.S. and Korean officials are likely to set out a specific schedule for monitoring beef production and trade and removing import restrictions consistent with the OIE guidelines. That will be done, and I think having a more concrete timeline will be useful for the U.S. Beef industry and exporters. The larger problem, however, is one that the negotiators can't resolve, and that can only be resolved by the legislators. The larger problem is that the longer hiatus from the Korean beef market, the long hiatus during the BSE crisis, has given U.S. competitors a dominant share of the Korean market, primarily Australia. U.S. producers will find it difficult to dislodge their Australian competitors, especially once Australia concludes its own FTA with Korea in the near future. U.S. Sales have been going up. The U.S. has improved its market share over the past year or more, but it is nowhere near the levels, indeed less than half the levels that U.S. Exporters had prior to the BSE crisis. I think there's a lesson there. If you stand on the sidelines and accede market share, it's often difficult to get it back. And that lesson can be generalized across our entire trade policy. Standing pat in this dynamic world economy of the 21st century means falling behind. Now, what will happen here in the United States? Rather than go through all the scenarios that will affect consideration of the CORUS FTA in the Congress next year, and everybody has their own ideas of what's going to happen in the election and the implications of the election for either facilitating or inhibiting progress on trade issues generally and the CORUS FTA in particular. But let me conclude with three reasons why I believe the Obama administration decided to accelerate efforts to resolve the impasse over the CORUS FTA earlier this year, despite the continued opposition of labor unions and others, and why I think the Congress will follow through if a deal is reached by the time of the Seoul summit in November of this year. The first reason is to demonstrate support for a strong ally facing North Korean aggression. I think when you look at the history of congressional debate on free trade agreements, often the foreign policy and security rationales end up dominating, as they did in the case of NAFTA. And here the case is so clear-cut it doesn't need much elaboration. And even if it wasn't clear-cut, even if it was less clear prior to this year, the actions by the North Korean Navy earlier this year certainly put a punctuation mark on the importance of the security rationale for this agreement. When the CORUS FTA was negotiated, the main concern related to North Korea was whether goods produced in the Kaesong Industrial Complex would be eligible for FTA preferences. Well, that debate is no longer of great interest. Since then, North Korea has taken a number of provocative actions, especially testing nuclear devices and launching offensive missiles, that underscore the importance of a strong and durable alliance between the United States and South Korea. Neither country wants to let a few provisions in a major trade agreement create friction in an incredibly important bilateral alliance. Second reason is to secure a level playing field for U.S. exporters in the Korean market. Korea has, as I mentioned before, has concluded or is negotiating FTAs with most of its major trading partners, and by definition, these deals discriminate against U.S. exporters and investors. The imminent signing of the Korea-EU FTA, an agreement modeled on and largely comparable to the CORUS FTA, increases the urgency of congressional action on the CORUS FTA, since U.S. and EU exports compete for sales in the Korean market, particularly in autos. The EU-Korea deal is now scheduled to be signed on October 6th and to enter into force on July 1st, 2011, at which time European firms will benefit from tariff preferences in the Korean market, largely comparable to those that had been expected to have been already available to U.S. firms. I'm doing separately an analysis of the two agreements, and what we found is substantial trade diversion if the EU-Korea deal is implemented and the CORUS FTA remains on the sideline. So there is a reason to move forward to level the playing field, and indeed that will restore most of the benefits that that the U.S. firms would expect to achieve from the CORUS FTA. The third reason relates to the ability of U.S. officials to advance U.S. economic interests through an effective trade policy. The long delay in ratifying the CORUS FTA sends a signal to U.S. trading partners that U.S. officials don't have the requisite political support to follow through on agreements reached at the negotiating table. Such concerns do not prevent them from negotiating with the United States. They're there, they're talking, but foreign officials are inclined not to put their best cards on the table for fear that they will have to renegotiate the deal to assuage a skeptical Congress. And indeed, they only have to look at what the Congress did with the CORUS FTA in May of 2007 to note that that's a possibility. Implementing CORUS is thus important to help maintain the credibility of other U.S. trade initiatives, both multilateral in the World Trade Organization and regional in the Asia Pacific, that seek to boost U.S. exports and advance U.S. foreign policy and security interests. I think if our negotiators are able to craft a deal that increases the benefits for both the United States and Korea from the CORUS FTA, that we will see a handshake in Seoul in early November, and we will see the Obama administration presenting implementing legislation of the Congress in 2011. But it requires a lot of work, and Wendy Cutler and her colleagues still have their work cut out for them. But there is a glimpse of optimism and three strong reasons to move forward in the coming months. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm sure there's probably a lot of questions to the audience. We have microphones, so please raise your hands, and if you could take and provide your name and affiliation, and we'll go ahead and open up to questions from the audience now. Yes, Joe. Right.
Thank you. I enjoyed your comments. Thanks very much, Jeff. I would be interested in your assessment of congressional attitudes toward trade in general. Have we seen a sea change in the Congress over the past decade? Are we now in a different place than we have been since the end of World War II, where trade is no longer seen as a positive engine of growth, but rather a negative drag on U.S. jobs and income for working class Americans? Has that led to a sea change, or are we just in a cyclical downturn that you foresee us coming out of?
We're in an entirely different world than when you and I were together in government. And the situation today is much more difficult for pursuing trade policy than in recent years. Two main points with regard to this. One is that the U.S. economy is much more open to trade than it was a generation ago. And so Congress really didn't care that much about trade. That's probably a politically incorrect way to say it. But when I went to get congressional approval for a new strategy for the Tokyo round in the 1970s, I had to talk to the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and the chairman of the Finance Committee. And if when they got their approval, that was basically it. There wasn't, they carried the can for the rest of the Congress. Now, dealing with those gentlemen was not easy. They were very powerful members. But there were fewer members who had a direct constituent interest because trade was such a small share of economic activity in the United States, and therefore their constituents weren't as effective. Now the ratio of trade to GDP has tripled from that time, and many, many people are affected in terms of not only their consumption patterns, but also production and employment. And so many, many more members of Congress, in fact, most members of Congress, now are concerned about trade and the implications of trade for their constituencies. Now, some of those concerns are narrowly focused on a specific sector or product, some on particular issues which their constituents are concerned about. My representative is concerned about human rights, and so he makes a big push on that in the Congress. So that's become much more difficult. The second area where it is very difficult to conduct trade policy now is because unemployment is so high. And not only is unemployment high, but the share of workers unemployed who have been unemployed for a long time, defined as more than 6 months, represents now almost half of the total. That creates a lot of angst and pain in the general public. And I think the Congress recognizes that. They seem to be at a loss for what to do about it and have not done very much. And indeed, they even argue irrationally about extending unemployment benefits for the people who are losing them because they have been out of work for so long. But that colors the trade policy debate dramatically. And that's not going to change too much over the next few years because the unemployment rate is likely to only improve gradually as our economy moves forward. and the prospects for a very sharp recovery have been diminished, at least according to recent forecasts. This is where the president's export initiative is an important signal, but it is not going to yield the major results in the short term. It is a way of setting a tone for restructuring of investment and medium-term business strategies looking abroad that will have paid dividends over time, but not in 2011. So that's where the big changes are, I think, and that's part of the reason why the trade agreements, the Doha round, other trade initiatives have gotten caught up in this wash. The most important thing is the welfare of the people of the United States, and they're hurting right now.
Ernie.
Ernie Preet, Manufacturers Alliance. For FTAs and trade liberalization, generally, the House has been a lot tougher than the Senate. So my question is, how much difference will it make if in 2011 the chairman of the committees, the subcommittees, not to mention the speaker, are Republicans rather than Democrats?
Okay. I'm happy to answer this because I am not a political pundit, so I can give you my objective assessment. I think that it is clear that Republicans will make large gains in both houses of Congress, and they could take control of the House. Whether they take control of the Senate or not, there have been some odd things in the recent primaries, so at least that's a little more questionable than it was a couple of weeks ago. How these events affect trade votes, though, is harder to assess. Since newly elected members in both parties may tend to take more protectionist positions than their predecessors. Over the past two decades, we've seen the U.S. trade debate becoming much more ideological in both parties, on the left wing and on the right wing. And both the left wing and the right wing have become much more protectionist, certainly since NAFTA. I think if the Republicans gain control of the House, their leaders are likely to push for ratification of the CORUS FTA. But they will have to pressure the right wing of their party, because they're going to need a large majority of Republican votes to carry a implementing legislation. They will get a minority of Democrats to support it. But this has been the pattern since the NAFTA. Trade agreements have passed generally with large Republican majority and the requisite Democratic minority needed to get over the halfway line. And I think we'll see that happen again. So you may have a replay of the CAFTA debate, but I think the national security rationale will loom large in this debate and will probably be decisive.
Peter.
Peter Whitney. I teach economics courses at several universities. The devil's in the details, and on the beef, which is easier, I can see, than the autos, how far away is the allowing beef in that's less than 30 months of age? How far away is that from whatever the OIE guidelines are? And then one other quick question. The president and many members of Congress talk about tax changes to penalize overseas U.S. investment, which is clearly a part, as you mentioned with the GM investments in Korea and so forth, is a part of the U.S. Maintaining its competitiveness around the world. So how much does that play in, and how can that perception be changed, that overseas investment actually helps our international competitive balance. Thank you.
Well, on the beef issue, according to the OIE rulings in 2008, the market should be open. And but the response among the Korean public was such that the negotiators thought we needed to find a way to ease into it. And that was essentially the nature of the 2008 agreement. But it was necessarily vague in terms of endpoint. Well, we've had a period now where there has been more consumption of American beef in the Korean market, and the attempts will be to try to have a clearer definition of coming into conformity with the appropriate monitoring, because all of this is conditioned on not having a relapse of the problem in the U.S. So I think that's something that can be worked out. Will be worked out, but it has to be done very carefully. In terms of the tax issues and the like, my colleague Gary Huffbauer has done some wonderful, incisive pieces on the broader issue of tax policy and international trade, and I'd just refer you to those, because he has written on the issues in the current debate, and instead of trying to reprise the arguments of someone who was the head of the international tax staff of the Treasury before he joined me in the trade negotiating world.
Stephen.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to see you again. And you've been working on this, I know we've written about this for a long time. I'm Stephen Collins with the American Automotive Policy Council. So many things I wanted to bring up, but let's just talk about the your premises on why now, why this has to be done by November, which is basically a foreign policy. Number one is foreign policy dominated reason. And I think there were many, going back to the debates over trade and going up leading up to the last election, who said this was part of what was wrong with our trade policy for the last several decades that led to trade agreements of which the United States suffered and did not gain advantages, because it was foreign policy considerations that were allowed to dominate, you know, basic economic calculations in these trade agreements that we've had going back many years. And there is a substantial trade discussion over trade policy that the Democrats raised leading into the election that hasn't been answered yet, that hasn't been engaged yet, and perhaps this is the engagement. But it was raised by the president during his, and the auto issue and the beef issue was raised by the president repeatedly during the campaign. We saw in the auto industry, the American auto industry, that during the negotiations, Korea made auto issues its number one objective. As you said, the Korean auto industry, which the whole long story about how it became the country that, that exports 70% of its auto production, has $10 billion out of a $12 billion surplus with the United States. That's not normal. It has a 4% to 5% import share. That's not normal. It's an aberrational industry, which includes the Europeans and the Japanese. I think the first Toyota was sold there two years ago. The European community just did approve conditionally an FTA with Korea, but the conditions which have to be sent back to the European Parliament include three or four conditions specifically related to further work that needs to be done to improve further the automotive provisions of the FTA. So that's not a done deal. And they also want to know, they want all the benefits of what we're going to do here. Finally, Jeff, I just wanted to question, because you know very well the terms of the 1995 and 1998 trade agreements called MOUs between the U.S. and Korea, specifically on auto issues. The issue then in 95, the issue again in 98, was that Korea effectively used non-tariff barriers very effectively for to keep all parties at bay in their market. And really what your prescriptions were for this negotiation, where the stakes are so much higher, is greater transparency and somewhat better dispute settlement procedures. And that sounded to me very much like what we already had and didn't work. So I wanted to ask you about those. Well, I don't want to go on too long. I just wanted to make a couple of points.
And if I could just ask you real quick to maybe put some of that in context by talking about areas where perhaps the U.S. has large surpluses in Korea to sort of balance it out, if you have some of those numbers in hand.
Well, let me first say that if the debate over the chorus and particularly the auto provisions were conducted by Steve and proponents, we wouldn't be in this position, because there have been a rational debate and understanding of the issues and an accommodation long ago. And it has been some of the more extreme views that have been voiced in talking points repeated ad nauseum by members of Congress that have created, I think, a situation where it's difficult to understand what the real problems are. I don't find fault with much of what Steve has to say, but I will put it, I will react to it in a different way. Why now? Well, I gave three reasons, and the first you discount because you say, well, foreign, I'll paraphrase it briefly, you'll say, why should foreign policy rationales trump commercial considerations? And the answer is foreign policy, national security is very important. And the commercial considerations overall for the U.S. economy are so much to the advantage of the U.S. That it is not a question of one trumping the other. It's a package deal. And particularly, why now? Because we are at the verge of significantly losing additional market share because of other agreements that Korea is going to be entering into. So while we could coast for a couple of years with a gradual decline in our market share in Korea, I think your companies are going to lose their small sales in the Korean market. Now, GM won't. GM will benefit, but there will be costs, because European manufacturers will have an 8% tariff preference in shipping the higher priced, higher marked up vehicles to Korea. So there's a problem there. With regard to the MOUs, I think you're absolutely right to recall that experience. The Koreans did not adequately implement or enforce, live up to the terms of those agreements, and that has left a bad taste in the mouth of a lot of people. And that those memories are still very clear. Now, has the situation changed in the Korean market? And the answer is quite a bit, both because of globalization, because of the participation of GM in Daewoo, because of new regulatory policies that have been, albeit imperfect, but improvements over what existed in the 1990s. I think this requires a much more detailed discussion between experts like you and others, but these are legitimate questions to ask that you've asked, and I think they're important. The only area that I would quibble with you is saying, well, it's abnormal to have a large bilateral trade deficit in a product. Well, it's not abnormal to have a large bilateral trade deficit in a product. It's abnormal to have a large bilateral overall deficit if there's something rigging the trade. And that's a debate that occurred all last week with regard to China and the exchange rate. But you know, saying some of the arguments that were made in the Congress saying that there should be balanced trade is like saying we sell several billion dollars a year in agricultural products to Korea, and the agreement is going to expand that quite a bit. And the Koreans should object until they can sell a couple of billion dollars of Korean agricultural products in the U.S. That doesn't make any sense. We have a couple billion dollar trade surplus with Korea on agriculture. What's important is the overall composition and make sure that there is non-discriminatory access and that the conditions for competition are not rigged. And no trade agreement is going to be perfect in that regard. This agreement, I think, has greatly improves the prospects for trade and investment between our two countries. But I appreciate that you've put the issues in a very substantive way, and that is a way that the negotiators need to take into account as they're working out the details, because they need to come up with a result that will make you feel a little better about this deal, too.
Claude has a question up here.
All right.
Automobiles. Jeff, I agree Steve is a mellow and rational guy. But basically what he said was that what seems to him is on the table on autos is a sham, if I understand. He's here to talk for himself. Because the regulatory stuff that you talked about rather vaguely, because maybe we don't know what they're doing, or the whole the question, the other issues that have been put forward on autos, he doesn't seem to think make any changes. Forget about the changes that we've had in the Korea economy, but specifically what is going to be in the FTA. It sounds to me as if I don't know how the automobiles, whether the General Motors is or Chrysler or Ford, but it sounds to me as if that association is still very much opposed to what seems to be brooded now, and that they maybe have not moved away from the kind of managed trade approach which you and I and others would disagree with. So it seems to me there's a much greater disagreement. I'm happy to have the accommodation in this room, but in terms of the two of you, but I don't see there's much agreement, but you're both here in the room.
Well, first of all, there is change, and the Koreans have been moving towards adopting European standards. Second, while certain constituencies will publicly maintain pressure on the negotiators to improve the deal, I think that's normal in this stage. Hopefully, Steve is also providing them some advice on what would be useful reforms on the details. I hope you're doing that, Steve.
Yeah, in the back right there.
Juan Kim from Patent Box. Can you give some quantitative correlation between employment or unemployment and export with respect to Chorus? I mean, what you expect to be the change, improvement or non-improvement? Thank you.
I expect that the Chorus FTA, like any other trade agreement, will affect the composition of employment and not the actual level of employment in both countries. And so it will lead to increased jobs in certain sectors and decreased jobs in other sectors. So there will be a movement. But on balance, studies of previous agreements have shown that the jobs created are generally higher paying and more secure in terms of the durability of employment than the jobs displaced. Any individual trade agreement is going to have a very small impact on an economy as large as the United States and on the U.S. labor market. And so all of this will be, if you try to use equations to figure out or big models to figure it out, this is all going to be in the noise, in the statistical noise. But what is important is the point that I raised at the very beginning of my talk, to use the agreement to help spur productivity, growth, and innovation in the economy. And this will require some adjustments. And if the agreement can do that, over time, over the medium term, that that increased productivity will lead to permanent increases in employment.
All right. Since we're running out of time, why don't we take these two questions, last questions together? So Dr. Chung and then the gentleman in the back here.
Hi, Chol Chung, Korea International Trade Association. Obviously, the main issue is the autos. So going back to autos again, we just witnessed that that there's a big disagreement or the gap actually in the opinions. So what would you suggest the policymakers or some other people like yourself and Steve and other people, other relevant parties to do before the November, to narrow the gap of the disagreement?
Okay, let's go ahead and get this gentleman's question back as well.
Hi, back to autos. I'm Bill Canis with the Congressional Research Service. You mentioned in your remarks, Jeff, that some words about managed trade in autos in Korea. Could you be more specific as to what terms are managed trade, and could you compare that with the Reagan administration's voluntary trade agreements with Japan on autos a number of years ago? Thanks.
Well, the Reagan administration's policies are no longer allowed under world trade rules. So that was an example of managed trade. But I was referring specifically to proposals that Sandy Levin and others put forward in, early March 2007, seeking a greater balance in the flows of autos between the two countries before certain aspects of the deal would be entered into force. Basically, a bilateral balancing of the trade. That's what I was referring to. Now, the entire debate has gotten a little confused because of this, and because it is so seductive or attractive for politicians to say, we import 700,000 cars from Korea, and Korea only imports 5,000 cars from the United States. I mean, something's got to be amiss there. And to be sure, the import share of the U.S. market is substantially larger than Korea. And the question is, will the Korean import market share increase over time as a result of these trade agreements, not only with the United States but with Europe and others? But if you look at sales in the U.S. market and sales in the Korean market, you get a little different view of the story. And sales incorporate the foreign cars, foreign branded cars that are both imported into the country and produced in assembly plants in the country. So Hyundai and Kia account for 6-7% of U.S. sales now, and they've grown quite dramatically over several years, but about that much. GM Daewoo account for about 9 or 10% of Korean sales, most of that produced in Korea. So this is a short way of saying you can pick your statistic to make your argument. And what is important is, are you pursuing policies that will promote production and employment in both countries? And how is the best way to do that? And I think in answer to Dr. Chung's question, the best way to do that is to encourage the types of innovative partnerships that we have begun to see emerge over the last year or two. That increase investment, U.S. government stimulus funds and the state government of Michigan funds have gone into this plant in Holland, Michigan, creating jobs in Michigan and production that will supply new electric cars. I assume the Korean government is doing the same in terms of innovations, in terms of engine technology. And here, our companies can actually benefit from working with each other to get the investment needed and advances in technology that will make them much more globally competitive. So I think the purpose of the efforts would be, how can we make U.S. and Korean firms more competitive in competing against firms against imports and against production in other countries? How can we have a better product that Americans will want to buy? And I think we're beginning to see that turn around. Ford and Chrysler and GM are doing better now this year from a very difficult situation last year. But the key will be whether the new products prove to be attractive to the American consumer and to foreign consumers. And that will require continuing to stay ahead on the technology curve and produce a better, more efficient vehicle. So that's where I think the longer-term benefits come. But I think to assuage the political concerns and some of the issues regarding regulatory policy, there will be need to be greater transparency and accountability and monitoring of regulatory process.
All right. Before thanking Jeff, I would just like to make one brief announcement. Next Tuesday, we will actually be having a lunch with Governor Kim Moon-soo from Korea. He's the governor of Gyeonggi Province, which is the largest or the most populous province in Korea. It's economic powerhouse and it surrounds Seoul. He's going to be talking on expanding economic opportunities between the United States and Korea, so it should be a very interesting discussion, and I'd like to invite you all to attend. And with that, I'd like to thank Jeff for a very informative and enlightening discussion, and I'm sure we've all learned a lot more today about this important topic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more information, please visit our website at www.keia.org.